Hello again, and welcome back to another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And in this episode, we're going to go into healthcare. Now, this is a topic I've always kind of avoided like plague when I worked in innovation consulting. Actually, I still work in innovation consulting. Anyway, I've always kind of avoided healthcare projects because they always seemed complicated, big, slow, and just really hard to get anything done. But if we don't talk about healthcare, how are we going to make cities better places to live and to play and be happy and healthy in? Much of healthcare today is kind of broken. Much of healthcare today is kind of a miracle, but it could be so much better. So I thought, who do I know that can talk about this really, really clearly and not really hold back? And I have someone fantastic. And she lives just outside a city that could be a bit of a challenger, that if you're not in Canada or Michigan, you've probably never heard of. Sault Ste. Marie, the Sioux. Anyway, this is going to be a conversation with Anna Folt. And she's really passionate about healthcare. She understands a lot of the challenges and she sees a lot of the positives. So we're going to talk about all sorts of weird and wonderful things in here, how we can break down some of the bureaucratic barriers, how we can innovate in the margin, and really what this system that is under strain needs and how cities can do something about it. So I learned a lot. I think it's a really complicated problem. And hopefully this just moves the conversation in a good place. So without further ado, here is a conversation about healthcare and cities with Anna Folt. That's why I really want to talk to you, because you make healthcare interesting. So rather than me ramble on a bit more, like, Anna, like, these things start with quite well, where, like, tell us a little bit about you, some of the other interesting things that you are up to in the back and beyond of somewhere outside Sault Ste. Marie.
So I got involved in healthcare advocacy a little more than a decade ago, had some experiences with the healthcare system that kind of motivated that interest. And from there, it opened the door to all kinds of opportunities that have been super fulfilling to me, but that would never have been available to me. So I sat on Dr. Devlin's hallway, Council to End Hallway Medicine on the innovation side for a while, trying to solve for, you know, this big, as you mentioned, complicated rat's nest of a problem. Spent some time on a hospital board. I've been working with Ontario MD, and most recently I've just finished training and I'm kind of part of the team. I'm a volunteer search and rescue firefighter north of Sault Ste. Marie. So actually working in this system and watching how all the players kind of come together. And I think you're right. It is complicated, but it's so important that it's like, of all the wicked problems we're solving, solving this problem around healthcare in cities is so critical, and it just doesn't seem to be getting better. And I think the kind of historical reluctance for people inside the healthcare system to welcome kind of insights or points of view or ways to think about the problem is slowly receding, because I think it's just getting worse. And I think doing kind of the things that we know better, differently, faster, people were realizing that is not a solution to the problem. We need to think about the problem differently. And that's, I think, where this kind of outsiders or innovation really comes into the play.
Like, we've had this assumption growing up, and I can say this as a Brit who has become Canadian, but with this little spell in the US, which was kind of frightening, and that how healthcare works or doesn't work there. But we're very accustomed to healthcare is free. Like, there's something wrong, I can go see a doctor, I can go get treated, and I don't need to worry about it. However, that system of healthcare being free is becoming really, really expensive, harder to manage, and it's slowly eroding, and it may quickly erode if we let it continue much longer. How do we get to that point? How do we get to here where it's like someone who has avoided healthcare like the plague is now like, oh, healthcare's quite interesting?
I think nothing's free. But I think people's perception is that it's free, and a bunch of things are happening, right? Doctors are practicing medicine differently than they did 20 years ago. So it used to be that general practitioners, this was kind of their life's vocation, and they worked 80 or 90 hours a week. And new doctors don't want to work that way. And so we're having people, doctors retire, there's not enough new doctors coming in, and the ones that are coming in might have to, by nature of how we fund healthcare in Canada, not just be a primary care physician. Many of them teach at a university, maybe have a private clinic or run dermatology or something like that. So not only do they not want to work 90 hours a week in family medicine, they can't financially afford to do that because the system's not set up for them to bill in the same way that they could 20 years ago. And then people are living longer with chronic disease. So it's actually a lot more complicated than it was 20 years ago. So, and it, all this stuff is all worldwide. Like, you know, Canada gets very kind of down on ourselves about, you know, this is this terrible situation, but the NHS has the same challenges. You look almost anywhere in the world and the challenges are the same because those macro factors are consistent. People are living longer with chronic disease. They expect to live well. They don't expect to kind of work and then spend 3 or 4 years, retire and die. They expect that they're going to live to their 90 and live well into their 80s.
It's like, I don't think we think about it very much of like when these systems were set up, it was basically 2, 3, 4 years between retirement and death.
Yes.
And then now, obviously, that's not how the world works. Like, I should have had the stat ready to go, but I saw this thing around like the amount of money that is spent. So once you're 80 and above, I think it was in the context of the UK, but the vast amount of money that goes into your healthcare at that point. And as you have an aging population and a lower tax base, it becomes like, it's just not sustainable. So you've got to find a way around it.
Well, and the interesting kind of counterpoint to that is it costs so much money. And I think, you know, everyone as like a default wants their loved one, let's say your parent or grandparent, you know, you don't want them to pass. But there's a big question about like how all these interventions. So we have all these affordances, but how many of them actually represent like a better quality of life? Like, do you want to live for 3 more years? Like, you know, a facility hooked up to a bunch of machines? Like, it, I mean, we can do it. It's possible. But is it desirable? And
it's
those
an
were
uncomfortable
not
conversation.
Well, 20 years ago, it's like you just had a massive coronary heart attack and you dropped dead, or you had a stroke and you dropped dead. And now it's like, No, we can intervene on all those things and create outcomes. But, you know, is the outcome that you want? And I don't think anyone's having that conversation. But, and it's not to be so ghoulish, like, you know, let's make sure that we don't spend any money. But I think oftentimes in retrospect, people will talk about, you know, that last 6 months or the last year or whatever was a terrible experience. So we're spending all this money for a terrible outcome.
And then I think you have the thing around kind of chronic illness that we spend a lot of the time on the responsiveness to it rather than being preventative. And
yes.
I think that was the sort of thing that got me more interested in healthcare again, because we don't make the healthcare point of if you have more people using public transit or biking or like cities that are designed for walking around, you end up with people that they're not fitness freaks, but they're just outside being more active each day. They're being more social because it forces you into interactions with other people. And therefore, they tend to be happier and like mentally healthier and physically healthier too. I think it was the Netherlands where people were prescribing railway tickets.
Yes.
Basically saying like people who had depression, like, here's a train ticket. Go to another town, go explore, go to a museum, spend the day out. And you like,
yeah.
It sounds really sort of the thing that I can imagine a lot of people just roll their eyes at the thought of that. But like, that's a huge part of healthcare really to me.
I think, I don't know which healthcare region is doing this. I think it's Ontario, but they're prescribing passes to provincial parks. Same thing for people who maybe don't have the means to pay, but live close to one of them. It's so great for your mental health. And I remember reading a while ago, France was using posties who were kind of in decline in terms of how much mail was being delivered, to do elderly check-ins, like well check-ins, and just having conversations with the people on their route. And I just think that's so smart, right? They have that relationship. They're walking by the house anyways. And that 5 or 10 minute conversation might be very, very meaningful to that person who's lonely and elderly and isolated.
So when we spoke before doing this recording, we talked about Sault Ste. Marie. And a lot of people won't know where Sault Ste. Marie is, or the fact that there's two of them. But it's quite a good, I thought it was quite an interesting example of where
like smaller cities can do things differently. In some cases, they can do things a lot better. In some cases, they face a lot bigger challenges than other places face. Like, can we talk through a bit like healthcare in the sewer, like, and go from there and use it as a bit of an anchor point?
So Sault Ste. Marie is in Northern Ontario. It's about 9 hours north of Toronto. It's a border town. It borders Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And that's the kind of twin cities. It's historically been a steel town, so there's been a big steel plant here for many, many years. It's about 75,000 people, so it's not a huge city, but it's a city. And it definitely has its own kind of vibe. It's very people that get up and get to itiveness. There's a toughness with people, and people are very proud to be from Sault Ste. Marie. We used to joke, people would leave Sault Ste. Marie to go for higher education, and there's like this Sault Ste. Marie club of people in London, Ontario, because London is not Toronto. So it's not so scary as like the big city of Toronto. And you go to these parties, these Sault parties, all these Sault Ste. Marie people then find each other again. But healthcare has been a big concern in the Sault for a really long time. And to your point, was solved in a really creative way. So when the steel plant kind of set up shop in the Sault, one of the concerns was, how do we recruit people to this place that for many people is the middle of nowhere if we don't have appropriate healthcare? And so they set up this organization called Group Health, and the steel plant workers kind of had like an insurance group benefit scheme where they paid in to building this facility. Think of it almost like a mini hospital. Like it's staffed by doctors, nurses, nutritionists, PSWs, like really a full kind of suite of services. And at the height of Group Health a few years ago, they rostered about 50,000 patients in a town of 75,000. So they were the dominant player. Almost everyone in Sault Ste. Marie, whether they worked at the steel plant or had a family that worked at the steel plant, received care at Group Health Center. There's also a full hospital in the Sault. So if you live in Sault Ste. Marie, Sourire Hospital is the hospital. There's another more major trauma center in Sudbury, but Sudbury is 3 hours the other direction. So Sourire Hospital is kind of the anchor for all non-family medicine, you go to your doctor and get checked up. Sourire Hospital is the place. And so you can imagine there's a quite symbiotic relationship between not only the practitioners, but also kind of that continuity of care between Group Health, Sourire Hospital, and how they kind of flex on each other. Just like in other places in the province, Sault Ste. Marie has suffered from doctors retiring, difficulty in recruiting new doctors, and difficulty in a way that's different from a major urban center like Toronto or Hamilton or London, in that when they need to kind of staff hospitals or roster patients, there's like a proximity. So a doctor could decide to take a shift in Toronto, but they live in Hamilton because that's like a 45-minute hour drive. What happens in the Sault is we don't have that flexibility because the nearest place is Sudbury, and no one's driving. Well, they sometimes do, unfortunately, but it's not as easy to drive 3 or 4 hours. So a lot of the way that they've had to backfill is with locums flying people in from Southern Ontario, Alberta, wherever we can find people to kind of backfill. And the other unique challenge is it's really hard to get specialties. So dermatology in Sault Ste. Marie, I read the kind of congratulations for the retirement of a doctor who has flown from Mississauga to Sault Ste. Marie to deal with dermatology. He's the only one. My husband, who's 57 years old, was treated by this doctor and he just retired. So he has been like, God love the man, a constant force in Sault Ste. Marie. But now the question is, who will replace him? Like, who's willing to do that? That's like a gigantic gift to a city that does not have that sort of resourcing. But then things like obstetrics, anesthesiology, like you can see when you're running a very tight ship, how different that is somewhere here, both from a practitioner standpoint, as well as a patient standpoint. It's not like you can just easily drive somewhere else. This is kind of the only game in town. And just west of us, the hospital shut down quite a few times because the locum doctor has missed a flight. The flight has gotten delayed. The weather conditions prevent them from driving. There's not available staff to backfill from Sault Ste. Hospital. So there's just not a lot of wiggle room. The great Sarah Newberry, who is a physician in Marathon, Ontario, has this great quote that says, you know, when the grass is burnt in Southern Ontario, Northern Ontario is on fire.
You talked to me a little bit about developing, like, there's a school in Northern Ontario that's developing medical talent locally, because I found a lot of the time, like, you have smaller cities and the thing becomes, oh, you want to develop and then you have to move away. And that was actually some of the origins of the whole Challenger City thing. We were way, way, way back in a completely different sector. But actually, like, the thing that is often the reality is there's lots of people who don't want to move away, but they need the opportunity. So while there's this issue with dermatologists in Mississauga that need to fly up and have been flying up all this time, does that create opportunities for them, people who are like, there's pathways through, but you have to develop the talent, you have to provide the proposition effectively to say, you can have an amazing career as your specialty or even as a general practitioner in places like the Sioux?
Yeah. So Northern Ontario School of Medicine, or NOSM as it's referred to, really big challenge they're trying to solve is it's not sustainable to bring someone from Alberta to the Sioux. A, it costs more money. So number one, you have to pay them a premium to come. You have to pay for their travel. There's people that have been on long-term locums in the Sioux and we're super grateful. But a lot of people do a locum to pay down their student debt or augment their income. They're not part of the community. They don't understand the community. They're practitioners. They're very qualified, but they kind of come in, do a job, and then leave. So in order to kind of have any kind of HR workforce planning or, you know, and because all of these systems are so intertwined, NOSM has done an amazing job of recruiting people that want to practice kind of family medicine, rural generalists, people that want to be in Northern Ontario. They like the exposure of, I'm not in this very niche silo where I'm going to go very deep on one thing. I'm going to sit in an emergency room in Sault Ste. Marie and there's going to be a transport crash on the Trans-Canada Highway. There's going to be kids that have an ear infection, like the whole gamut you're going to see, and you're going to see and treat them yourself because there's no one else to treat them. It's kind of a bit of, you're going to learn quickly because you're forced to face just a very wide variety of things. NOSM has been so successful at doing that. And I think they've been very smart about how they recruit, who they recruit. To your point, that value proposition, they're very clear on the fact that rural generalism is not for everyone. And like, here's the great parts about it. Here's the scary parts about it. Like, is this something that appeals to you? And for the ones for whom it appeals, they stay. And so for us in Northern Ontario, that's what we want. We want continuity of care. We want doctors that are in our communities. We want doctors that understand kind of the challenges of living here and growing up here. We want Indigenous physicians. We want all of that. And we want to keep, once we train them, we want to keep.
Does it provide more of a pathway to experiment as well? Because again, you were telling me a little bit about experience with your son breaking his arm. And in that example, as you talked it through, it felt like something that that's an experience that you would not get in a hospital in Toronto or in New York or in real London, not fake London.
No, my husband grew up, born and raised in Sault Ste. Marie, we moved here during the pandemic. So I am learning and like getting acquainted with all things kind of Sault Ste. Marie, Northern Ontario. And so I still have what Northerners call that Southie in me that get kind of is nervous that, oh God, is this going to be like good enough or good? And so my son broke both of his arms in his forearm playing dodgeball of all stupid things. And the school called, and where we live, there's no ambulances. They won't come this far. So the school called and said, please come, please pick up your son. He's had a terrible break. The fastest way to get him to the hospital is if you just come pick him up and drive him yourself, which I did. We're driving to the Sioux. We pull into the parking lot and my son bursts into tears and says, oh my God, Mom, it's so busy. It's going to take forever. And I said, well, you know, it's not first come, first serve. They will triage. So let's just go in with a positive attitude. But I will be honest, the back of my mind, I'm like, it's a really bad break. He's a little kid who's a jock. Like, I really want to make sure that this is set properly and like he doesn't have long-term consequences from this. And I will tell you, we walked in, there was a nurse probably in her 60s who I think has seen everything and done everything, completely unfazed. His arm, his hand was dangling, like he's holding his arm. It was terrible. And she just weighed him, looked at him and went, dear, okay. Put him on a gurney, calmly picked up the phone and called into the operating room and said, incoming reduction. And then said to my kid, you know, you get the VIP treatment. You're going right from triage right to the operating room, which both I was heartened by and also terrified of. So I'm like Googling what reduction is. I'm texting my friends who are doctors. I'm like, oh God, this is bad. But everyone was very calm about it. So that was like 11 o'clock in the morning. We get wheeled into this operating theater and the nurse came in and gave him some morphine, gave him ice. And the doctor came in and kind of was, unlike, as you say, any experience in Toronto, said, you seem calm. And I said, you know, my husband had a bunch of surgeries, like not my first rodeo. He did this amazing, the best risk declaration I've ever received. Again, my husband's had 12 surgeries, very, very direct. Just, we're going to give him ketamine. Here's the reasons why. It's safer for kids. Here's the risks, and kind of blunt risks. Like he said, the risk is that this part of his throat collapses and we can't unstick it and we have to do like a tracheotomy, which is terrifying. But this doctor said it in a very direct way and said, I've done one in my career. I might do another one in my career. That's how rare it is. And he made me feel very comfortable. I was like, okay. And then he said, do you want to stay in the room? And I thought, what? But then, you know, it's your kid. And I said, okay. And they worked as a team. They performed the reduction. That happened around 1 o'clock and we were discharged at 3 o'clock. And so this idea of rural generalism where it's like, this is a terrible break, but it's a break. They had two doctors, a respiratory therapist and a couple nurses came together, solved the problem and discharged me like so quickly. And we went to the orthopedic surgeon about a week later for a consult. And he's like, this is beautiful. Like, 10 out of 10, no notes. This is fantastic. And so all my friends in Southern Ontario were like, oh my God, were you so nervous? Like, I would have put him on a plane. I would have driven to Toronto. And I kind of said, I can't think of any better outcome than the outcome I actually got here.
There's a thing of doctors, of a lot of them are motivated by the weird stuff. Like the thing that I've not seen before, or is a bit quirky, or I don't see very often. It's like, There's a certain tranche of doctors that get off on that.
Yes.
And I feel getting that opportunity versus being like, here's another like broken ankle from someone slipping on the ice is like, yada, 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 whatever. It's almost like an important thing to keep entertained in a way that when you get everything that becomes siloed and sort of specialized, you can't have that.
Yes.
So when you sent me the thing around, and you talked to me before about dermatologists from Mississauga retiring or whatnot, that should be like a really exciting opportunity for the Sioux to be like, we've had this great thing of group health. We're now having a lot of patients de-rostered, but that opens up an opportunity to do something different. Like, because you can't keep doing the same thing that you did before because the conditions no longer exist. Are you starting to see that? Are you hopeful for that?
Like, I really am hopeful. I think, you know, the recent announcement that nurse practitioners and other allied health professionals can start billing, it's just, especially here, there's just no other short-term solution than to kind of widen the scope. There's this concept in medicine of like everyone operating at the top of their scope of practice. So how do we have family doctors not spend 20 hours a week doing administrivia, right? Because they didn't go to medical school 12 years to type in forms. How do we have nurse practitioners, again, be able to practice at the top of their scope? How do we think about human resourcing within the medical field, which has been very regulated, like static, certain people do certain things, no flexibility on that. And I think there's a way to be safe, you know, part of, as a patient advocate, part of kind of my push is I understand this ivory tower ideal world. In an ideal world, everyone would have a family doctor. Everyone, you know, would have access to this sort of care. But the reality is for the next, let's call it decade, because you can't grow doctors in a petri dish in, you know, 3 months, the state that we're in is not radically going to change. So, okay, so that's kind of like, you know, a block. So then what do you do? And the answer can't be, well, you just wait 12 years till we get some new doctors, because structurally that too is very hard to do. There's not enough residency spots. Like, there's 100 reasons why we've gotten into this mess. But the kind of the output of that mess is there's a bunch of people who have access to no healthcare who are getting sicker. And you can see in Northern Ontario just how it affects people's lifespan. The lifespan in Northern Ontario is shorter than in Southern Ontario. When you look at those stats that the government puts out about how many people don't have a family doctor, and you go somewhere even more north than me, some areas, especially Indigenous communities, there may be 75% of people with no access to any medicine. So people in Toronto kind of being frustrated that they lost their family doctor, listen, sympathetic, I don't have one either. But then you go north, and that percentage, when the government says it's 1 in 4, well, it's 1 in 4 in the province. It might be like 1 in 2 in Northern Ontario, and it might be 1 in 10 in Toronto. So the impact is not evenly felt.
Yeah. How do we get out the mess?
I honestly think part of it is, you know, being less rigid about who can do what and why. I see in Northern Ontario this collaboration out of necessity, and I think it yields really good outcomes. I think technology is a big part of it. I am very sympathetic. I've done an enormous amount of work now around technology in healthcare. And most healthcare technology is like circa 1990s. You know, EMRs are terrible. Hospital systems of record are terrible. Things that we've solved for in other verticals, like, you know, we still have nurses with clipboards taking notes. And then another nurse actually transcribes those notes, and then another nurse kind of moves them into another database. And when I questioned this during COVID, I was like, oh my God, like, we need nurses nursing. Like, this is data entry. Why do we have nurses doing data entry? Like, we can pay other people to do data entry. But there's just really old constructs of like, well, it's personal health information, and the only person that can deal with that is a nurse, which I understand the genesis of that. But like, the practical reality is you're sitting in your doctor's office, if you're lucky enough to have a doctor, and the receptionist is hollering your birthday, your oozing pus wound, your sexual history. Like, there's no privacy. And if that's not happening, you know, the fax is going, and, you know, the wrong fax is showing up at the wrong fax machine. So this idea that like, it has to be one way when you look at the reality of what's actually happening is like a huge fallacy. And I'm not suggesting that we de-emphasize the importance of healthcare privacy. I'm just suggesting that like, current state ain't great.
When I broke my shoulder earlier this year, like, I didn't have a doctor, couldn't, like, it was deemed not important enough, so it would be a long wait in the ER. Eventually, like, walk-in clinic, scan, whatnot, referred to a hospital. I think it was, I was going back for the third scan on it in the hospital, and I recognized the receptionist, and she was shouty on the phone. She was like rude the first time you were in there. But because I was now back for the third time, she was like, you're back again. And she was lovely to me. But even though I was going back for the third time, when I got referred to go for the x-ray on it, I went for the x-ray and they were trying to scan the wrong shoulder. And I was like, no, it's my left shoulder. And they were like, no, it says on the form, it's the right shoulder, so we have to do the right one. I'm like, okay. And I went back, I get sent back down the corridor. And she's like, what did I do? Wait, I just clicked the wrong button. And she'd like, on the drop down, had clicked right instead of left. And it was very nice and apologetic, but like, why are you doing that when this is like the fifth time that I'm having an x-ray on my shoulder, like, and the third time in this hospital? It just felt like you felt like lost of how are we in this situation where we're like using Windows 95 or whatnot.
Well, I mean, there's that. So like, this information share is terrible and then just makes work across the entire system. So like, that's one problem. But I think the other problem that I see, and I keep raising it at healthcare tables, is I understand that all healthcare practitioners want people to get access to care, and they feel terrible when there's a waiting list or it's not within kind of a clinical standard. And so, you know, the thing you need is this thing that's in short supply. They feel bad about saying, you know, you really just need this thing over here, but we can't do that for you for 100 reasons. So what they start to do, because I've experienced it, as has my husband, they start giving you like tangential things that like you don't really need, but it's like a busy work. It's like, okay, go over here and do this for a month, and then hopefully this waiting list over here kind of clears out. And, you know, my pushback on that is, do you ever just have an honest conversation that says, listen, it's terrible, but the current state is like, we can't get you over there in the time we want. Stop stressing the system, because me going doing this busy work is consuming other resources that maybe other people really need. So like, I am now part of the problem, the collective problem. And in an attempt to kind of keep everyone warm and move them around the system, we're just increasing people's utility of the healthcare system, which we all recognize should be scarce, because we're too polite. Maybe it's a Canadian thing to just say, we just can't do it. We want to do it. You should have access to it. It's, you know, criminal that you don't. But the reality is, this is the state of the nation. We just make busy work. And, you know, I joked with a friend of mine and I said, why can't I just have everything auto-renewed? I don't need to see the doctor. I get the doctor's time's precious. So why can't I give back my like 3 of my 5-minute appointments? I love when I had my family doctor when I lived in the Southern Ontario. Great. She was lovely seeing her. I don't really need that 5-minute chat because it's very basic. Like, it's very transactional what we're doing. Can I give 3 of those 5 minutes to like a diabetic who needs nutritional counseling that my doctor actually doesn't have the time to provide because I'm seeing her 3 times for a prescription renewal. Like, and I don't need to see her. Like, we could just do this over the phone and maybe meet once a year to kind of review how things are. But no, I have to go in because she has to bill, and like, it's this whole complex system. And then the diabetic, who will cost the system a heck of a lot more money when it's uncontrolled and they have, you know, greater acuity of their disease, we do nothing for that person because I and many others are clogging up the system with these 5-minute appointments that don't matter.
There's like a thing of, these are the metrics that we have to adhere to. I know the UK context of this is people want to get waiting lists down, but they also want to like shift the burden almost to somewhere that's not so, is more proactive than responsive. But the thing that you like bring up is like, we have this sort of fake economy of so-and-so has to bill such and such, and the perverse incentives are what breaks it effectively. And I don't know how you overcome that without taking bricks out the foundations and rebuilding them again.
Well, but I think I agree with you. And I think that's why it's been so resistant to change, because it's not that kind of startup mentality of like, you know, just do things until the thing breaks. It's like, we can't break the thing. It's people's health. So like, we're not burning the thing down. But what COVID kind of did is burned it down. So a lot of things are already burnt down with good intention. Like, you know, one of the things that was so obvious to me during COVID is triage has always been kind of bad for a whole bunch of reasons. And COVID happened, and then it got 100 times more complicated, 100 times more stressed. And instead of saying, well, this like never really worked very well, so like, now's an opportunity because the wheels have completely come off the bus, let's try to figure out a different way to do this, we just doubled down harder on the old way, like to the detriment of everyone around. So, you know, again, I respect clinicians being very cognizant of not harming. Like, I get that. But then by the same token, it's like, there's harm in the status quo. Like, continue knowing that this is broken and doubling down on it is harmful too. So like, which is more harmful? I don't know, but both are harmful.
I feel like there's this interesting experiment to be done almost, and it's hard to say doing an experiment when, again, it comes to people's health. But what would be the sort of smaller city approach to going, this doesn't work, how do we go and do it differently? And maybe you leave the old system running and then you set up a new system, and there's vast amounts of wastage and inefficiency and expense setting that up. But maybe if I was a sort of a nice billionaire, I would look at a place like Sault Ste. Marie and go, right, let the Ontario system do the Ontario system, but how would we design this differently? And if I do that really, really well, then how can I scale this elsewhere? And you end up in a really awful political conversation about public versus private in healthcare. But like, I feel like we're almost at that situation where you need to run 2 things side by side. And one is the old thing, one is the new thing, and you share the learnings effectively.
There's a bit of that happens in the Sioux, because we live right across the river from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. So if the wait list for an MRI is, you know, a year or 18 months, if you have the means, you can drive across the river. That's what St. Mary's River, you just go across the river and you can get that MRI. You can probably get that MRI in a week or less. You know, and I saw, I can't remember where it was in Ontario, but there was a new family doctor who was like, I'm accepting new patients, was trying to, like, how do you decide 2,000 patients that you, I think he was accepting 500 new patients. How do you decide who those 500 people are? Well, they lined up in the snow. This ridiculous, like Hunger Games to get a family doctor lineup of people. And I saw some of the online criticism, which was valid, but I'm also sympathetic to this physician who, I mean, I don't know what the better way would be, but the criticism was all of the people who are the most vulnerable, who probably need that doctor the very most, are not sitting in a snowy lineup for 6 hours because they can't.
I'm imagining sort of like America's Got Talent kind of auditions at this point of, no, I'm more injured. No, I'm more sick. Try and get listed with a doctor, which is just a depressing state of the world.
Well, and those doctors have to figure out how their roster is sustainable. Like, they can't have 80% of their practice be these high acuity, high need patients because it won't work. And so you kind of need that mix of, you know, young people who probably don't go to the doctor a whole heck of a lot. And they're for physicians in that capitated model where they get paid to kind of care for that person, that mix of, I might have an elderly person who's coming in every couple weeks because they have concurrent, you know, complicated issues. And I may have a 25-year-old who might come in once a year. And that kind of like balances out their roster a little bit. So I don't know the right answer to that. And again, there's lots of rules about what doctors shall and shall not do. But I can tell you, having a husband who had a major accident and injury and was prescribed narcotics, it is against the law to deny someone that is prescribed opiates from refusing them service. When we lost our family doctor in London, I knew well enough that despite that being the law, that there was going to be a huge bias from doctors who did not want to take us on as a family because of that. So I put on my Sunday best and looked like a nice Stepford wife and went physically to the offices that I heard might be accepting patients. And five of them in the province told me that they did not accept people who were prescribed opiates, which is completely illegal. And the private, I got so desperate, I went to, not Medline, I can't remember the name of it in London, Ontario. And I was like, I guess I have to pay. Like, now I'm at the end of the road, I'll have to pay. And they also told me, we don't take people like you. And I can only imagine how much harder it is for a non-middle-class white lady who got her loafers and trousers on and, you know, put on some mascara and lipstick and went in person and was told no. It's harder for anyone else with less privilege, if not impossible.
I thought about portfolio theory and doctors. That was not something that was in my mind of how they manage it like that. And that's really, really interesting. But also, like, the, again, it's adding to the problem. That's disturbing that people can then be declined effectively proper, fair, decent healthcare because the way they look, the way they talk, their medical history, whatnot. That just, I don't know. You're demoralizing me, Anna. Come on. Where's the hope here?
Well, I think there's a lot of people doing really great work. So, like, one person who is very attuned to challenges of vulnerable populations is a physician in Toronto called Dr. Andrew Buzzari. And he's doing something that I think is really, really smart. He's did a lot with COVID vaccinations, marginalized populations, like how that COVID rollout program work certainly did not deal with equity issues and did disadvantage vulnerable populations. And he was doing a lot of work to try to right that. But one ongoing thing is, you know, detox beds for people in alcohol withdrawal. People in alcohol withdrawal require supervision and medical care. But he did this model of, there was so much of it at his hospital and it was taking up so many beds and so many resources because, you know, you have a patient on one floor, a patient on another floor. He just opened a space and I think there's 10 or 12 beds, concurrent beds. So then you start to get some efficiency. It's like you don't need a nurse per all of those patients, but you do need one nurse to supervise someone going through withdrawal. And now you've taken those 12 people who used to be in wards and all over the hospital and you put them in one spot. you're probably providing much better care because it's actually tailored to the problem that they're having. And you're reducing the amount of human resources that is required to serve that population. You're reducing mortality. Like, I think it's those types of innovative solutions. And the thing he's doing now is housing for homeless populations, because the other big drain is, as you see encampments and homeless populations going up, the hospital is a warm place for people who, if they're homeless, they're probably ill. They probably have abscesses. They have all kinds of foot challenges because they don't have dry feet. And, you know, how do you, and the cost of that is enormous. The cost of walking into an emergency department for foot care is enormous, but that person has no other options. And so it behooves like us, the system leaders, innovators, to say, okay, how do we solve for that? And I think UHN did a very interesting thing where they took a parking lot and they're actually building housing. And they're like, if we just put these people in a home and provided some wraparound services, this wouldn't be a recurrent problem. Like, let's not have this be every 3 or 4 days we have the same person coming in and out. Let's actually get to the source of the problem. Let's go to first principles and solve it for them. But you kind of mentioned this idea of like not a lot of proactivity in the system. And I think that really is the fundamental issue. How do you do preventative things that cost pennies on the dollar in a system that's tapped just to try to deal with incoming emergencies? There has to be some way to start rationing or pulling care away, because that emergent acute stuff, if you don't deal with stuff proactively, it's just going to get worse.
Yeah. I think it's like, it's interesting just spending time in a hospital, which I'd never done until I actually had broken my shoulder, and then trying to find the place where you go, the right bit of the hospital that's in an old building from the 30s, 40s, 50s. Navigating it isn't necessarily the easiest. So you end up going around and seeing bits of the hospital that you wouldn't normally see. And it's interesting, like, when you go visit a sick relative, the number of people you see in a hospital, and you kind of wonder to yourself, why are you here? Like, how did you get to this point? And that it's shifting that. I think it's really interesting when you go around certain cities at the moment, you see huge amounts of homeless encampments. I saw like a comment on LinkedIn literally just now where someone said, put them all in jail, it'll be cheaper and cleaner. And it's like, it's just not, it's not helpful, but you have to sort of like have that awkward conversation to shift it. So it's really, really interesting of like seeing places that do this really, really well, and then seeing like the impact that that has on the broader system. So when your granny slips and had a fall, like she actually gets treatment quickly. And I think there's an emotional connection that you have to make to then the, like, how do we rationally manage this system and how do we do something differently? I think there's an opportunity there in healthcare to do something genuinely different, but it probably happens in smaller places than it does in big places right away.
Yeah. And that kind of test and grow, like, yes, it works. And yes, there was not harm. And maybe it has to get dire for people. And I think younger doctors, you know, are practicing differently and are demanding different things, which I think is good. And I think, you know, for all the kind of AI hype and all this kind of third horizon kind of stuff, there's really simple things like applying the tools that exist in other verticals to the problems that happen in healthcare. And, you know, healthcare is a bit of a snowflake. They are a special snowflake. Their problems are not necessarily the same. It's not like other verticals. They are different. But I think there's been like an over-rotation to, it has to be, it only can be this healthcare specific solution. I think there are some areas where they do need some niche solutions. Basic, like, I look at this clipboard problem and I'm like, OCR technology, you know, like searchable PDFs, like they're very, very basic things that can make a meaningful impact on the utility of a physician. Because I don't think any of us like want our doctor to be doing paperwork all day. They don't want to do paperwork all day. They want to heal people. That's why they spent 12 years in university plus. They don't want to sit there and fill out forms and be a stenographer.
When I broke my wrist when I lived in New York, I remember going into a walk-in clinic and they handed me a clipboard to fill out. And I was like, it's kind of hard for me to write on this. And they were like, well, that's the process. I was like, okay. So I like wrote with my right hand and I don't write very well. And they like looked at me and went, we can't read this. I'm like, I did say. And then they just like, come around here, and they're like, type it on that. So they let me type. They're like, we're not allowed to let you do this, but we're going to let you do this. It's just like when I broke my shoulder this year, it's like 10 years on, the process is still, here's a clipboard. And I just find that fascinating in this age of like AI, or like the amount of repeat data entries we alluded to earlier. I don't know why those things don't happen, but like there's certain basic bits of technology we just got to get right. And then how much more time does that free up?
Yeah. And like all of, and it's re-data entry over and over and over again. Like, you know, and reconfirming, because they have so little trust in their systems, because their systems are so ancient and don't talk to each other, that it's not just the data input and the data kind of typing. Then they're constantly not confident that the information in the system's correct. So then they spend more time validating that the thing that they're looking at is actually correct, which is a third time waste.
Do you see things happening like working for like a big insurer? Sometimes I find like insurance, those sorts of employee benefits programs can be really, really hard to navigate. But once you've navigated them, they can be fantastic. But you have that sort of, we can then lead on to the big, have people be more active, have get people to have like better like wellness provision. And then that has an impact on the healthcare service. Do you see like a trajectory there in terms of bringing that sort of private, albeit privileged world to the healthcare world, and that having an impact on how we solve the whole problem effectively? Because you talked about when we chatted before, like bike lanes in Sault Ste. Marie. But like one of the attractive things about Sault Ste. Marie is like it's quite a small city. You can finish work early, you can get on a bike and go ride like a fat tire bike in snow, things like that. And that makes you happier, healthier one. Are you seeing those like bridges between how we encourage more of that behavior and then how that has an impact on healthcare?
Yeah, like the frame that I use, and I use it kind of pre-pandemic, and it just is becoming more and more obvious. But I made this slide that had like the patient in the middle of this wheel. And, you know, no one in Canada wants to have this conversation about public and private. But the reality is about 30 to 40% of our system is private. And, you know, this wheel with this person in the middle, and it's like, oh, here are all the interested parties, right? Employer wants them to be productive. The government wants them to work and pay taxes. They want to be healthy. They want to be well. Who doesn't want to be well? And we want them to be well too. We don't want them to claim disability. We want them to do the things that will keep them healthy, happy, and active. So we all have this like same desire for the outcome. But the parties around that patient, they don't work together, like at all. So it's very kind of disjointed and discombobulated. And I think you're right. For those people that can kind of navigate through the public system and can navigate through what their benefits are and are, you know, invested in their own healthcare and want to be well, it's great. I mean, it's a very privileged position to be in. But I think we make it hard. All parties make it hard. Because we don't talk to each other, we don't engage with each other, but we all have the same interest. And if we just focus back on that person and like, how do we, knowing what affordances this person has, if they have insurance or if they don't have insurance, whatever, how do we do the best we can do for that person for the outcome that they want to achieve? But there's so much more work to do on that, because even inside the public system, you know, there's like this kind of paternalism and like, you shall do this. And then there's this frustration when people don't do those things. Cause it's like, well, we told you to do these things, but there's not often the question, which I ask, which is, why is the person non-adherent? Like they want to be healthy. So is it they can't access the treatment? Is it they don't understand why this treatment's important? Can they not afford it? Are there obstacles in their life that prevent them from being able to like do the things? Because I don't think people wake up in the morning and go, you know, I'm going to go to my doctor's office. I'm going to drive to my doctor's office. I'm going to pay for parking. I'm going to sit there for 45 minutes to an hour for a 5-minute visit. And then I'm going to throw out the window every single thing my doctor told me to do. Like people don't behave that way. But there's a lot of what the medical system calls non-adherence, but not a lot of inquisition or curiosity about why. And I think if we could be more curious about why, it would lead to some answers around what's better. So if this is not working, what's better? And is it we threw too much at the person at one time? Is it that they don't understand. I've been doing a lot of work with chronic illness. And when you actually read the qualitative research, a lot of times doctors explain the treatment in a very academic, doctorly kind of way. It just goes like this with the patient. They actually don't understand why they need to do this. And listen, no one wants to change. So it's like, I need you to change this, this, and this about your life. If you can't connect that change to like the impact it will have on you as a person, well, of course they don't do it because they're human beings. I would not do it either. It's like, well, they said all these things that sound complicated and hard and onerous. I don't know why I'd waste my time doing that. And then the doctor similarly is frustrated going, yeah, like I have no time. I made time. I spent an extra 5 minutes to see this person. I built up this plan and they're not doing any of the things.
There's a bit of fear as well. Like people don't, I know I have this, but it's by no means unique, but a lot of people are sort of scared of doctors. So they don't want to, or they could tell me something that's really, really bad and I'd just rather not hear that.
Yes.
And I don't know if we acknowledge that anywhere near enough.
We talked at the beginning about the quality of life and the cost of end of care life. I read a stat that said a third of all patients that are receiving terminal cancer diagnosis are unaware that their cancer is terminal.
Whoa,
so okay. In the doctor's attempt, so I think in a good way, like with empathy, are trying not to be harsh about this news, or maybe their own uncomfort with delivering that news, the patient leaves not understanding that they are terminal. And so then when they're asked, well, what interventions do you want? Well, if you don't believe you're terminal, you're like, all of them. I want all the things. Why wouldn't I want all the things? And not realizing that all of those interventions is a trade in terms of quality of life. And if you're not given the math on how you're making those trades, as a patient, you will make decisions that you might not have made if you actually understood kind of what the roadmap actually looked like.
Yeah. I want to ask you two more questions, if we can do that. One is like, what do you admire? Like, where do you look to in the world and go, my God, they do it so well. We should borrow, steal, be inspired by that.
The Netherlands. I think they do home care. And Zeyna Kayat, who is an amazing innovator, talks about this concept of homespital, that, you know, you're at home like 99% of the time. So what can you do to be well at home? It's what people want in terms of being ill. They don't want to be in a hospital. No one wants to be in a hospital. And the Netherlands does it really, really well to enable that. And we do it very, very poorly.
And if you had a magic wand that you could apply to making cities happier, healthier, providing better healthcare, whether it's preventative or responsive, what would you do with your magic wand?
I think the Sioux is doing some really good things. I think the Sioux is doing things like you mentioned, bike lanes and outdoor activities and this cohesiveness. I think what cities and healthcare need to really focus on is just this loneliness. People are lonely and people are really disconnected. So things that a city or a healthcare system could do to make people feel connected, whether that's connecting caregivers that are burnt out or cities creating events to bring people together. It doesn't fix all problems, but I think it's a step in the right direction. And then people won't feel lonely, isolated, hopeless, despair. Those things we can maybe mitigate. You know, delivering healthcare services is a trickier problem, but I don't think enough cities even have that as an ambition.
It's interesting just reflecting on the chat we've just had. I think we've mentioned AI once. We've practically not mentioned technology. And then virtually everything else we've talked about has been, how do you organize, manage structure? As well as how do you psychologically nudge, influence, communicate better? And in many ways, like I see this across a few conversations, that gives me a load of hope, because the problems that we're trying to solve really aren't that hard. We kind of know how to solve them. Is whether we have the will to see through the difficult things that upset somebody or make something awkward. But it just shows how hard it is, because we've got all this technology. We're actually worried about the tech. We're really worried about how do we deploy it and how do we influence people whose brains we might not necessarily understand. I keep coming back to that, and I don't know if it's because I'm obsessed with it, but it's almost every single topic, it seems to be the challenge. And to me, that's like really, really exciting to solve.
I think so too. It gives me hope as well.
Anna, thank you so much. Like, I really appreciate you having this chat with me. I'll share a link to your LinkedIn profile because you share really good and interesting things on there as well. And yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You did it. We made it. Thank you so much for listening to these episodes. It means a lot, and I hope we can make some positive change happen in the world. So here's to that. Here's to making cities happier, healthier places through changing this dodgy old world of healthcare. If you like this, do please like, do please share, do please get in touch with who else you'd like to see as feature, other topics, other questions, how we can do things better, and we will go on to make better cities and help cities be challengers. So here's to that. Thanks. Bye-bye.